Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
William Kent Kruger is the author of the Cork O'Connor Award-winning Mysteries, and in case you didn't know, for 2014, he was the recipient of the Edgar Award for Ordinary Grace. Tonight, he's here to present Wendigo Island, which is already getting starred reviews by Publishers Weekly and Booklist, and we're excited to hear about it. Please join me in welcoming William Kent Kruger.
Thanks, Beth. Before I begin my prepared remarks for this evening, there are a couple of stories I want to tell you that have to do with my connection to Denver. Just after my wife and I were married 40 years ago, we lived in Denver for about 10 years right after that. And in fact, the very first article I had published and for which I was actually paid appeared in the Denver Magazine. It was about hidden gold in the metro area. It was very melodramatic, and so I turned it into my editor, who happened to be a good friend of mine, which is why I got the assignment. And he cut my whole first paragraph, and I said to him, Mike, this is unfair. That's like the best paragraph in the whole thing. And he said, you know, Kent, we get to do what I want to do. And so I thought, okay, the hell with journalism. So that was the only article I ever had published as a freelance journalist. But the other thing that I did in Denver that I absolutely loved was I worked for the Denver Department of Parks and Recreation pretty much the whole time we were here. And I love this story. So 30 years ago, they renovated the Museum of Natural History. They did a big renovation of it and re-landscaped the grounds. And I was part of the crew that laid the new sod for the outside of that, the beautiful entrance to the structure. Spent a lot of time out there putting in sprinkler systems, laying the sod, getting it all very nice. And the governor was going to come and do the dedication of this new beautified museum. So we finished the job, got everything laid, and a couple of days later, the governor was going to come. Well, my bosses fell down on the job, and they never watered the sod. Yeah, so it died. And so the morning that the governor was going to come, there's all this brown, dead stuff. We went out with green spray paint and spray painted that entire lawn. It was a lot of fun, let me tell you. Okay, so let's see. I'm William Kent Kruger. I go by Kent. Is there anybody here who's never read a novel by William Kent Kruger? That's okay. You can raise your hand. I just kind of want to know. A couple of you? Three of you? Four of you? Well, I'm glad to see you here tonight. Usually I'd ask you to leave, but I'm feeling kind of unforgiving. I'm feeling very forgiving this evening, so you can stick around. No, actually, those of you who raised your hands, you are in large measure the reason that those of us do these things do them. So my first few moments of remarks are for those of you who raised your hand. I do publish under that very literary three-name thing, William Kent Kruger, but I do go by Kent. I currently live in St. Paul, Minnesota, a city I dearly love. I am, as Beth said, probably best known as the author of the, boy, do I love saying this, New York Times best-selling Cork O'Connor Mysteries series, which is set up in the Great North Woods of Minnesota. My protagonist, Cork O'Connor, is the former sheriff of the fictional Tamarack County, Minnesota. He's a man of mixed heritage. He's part Irish and he's part Ojibwe. Because of that mixture in his heritage, and largely because of the area in which I've chosen to set my work, a lot of the stories that I write come from issues that arise out of the interface of those two cultures, white and Ojibwe. So I've written about Indian gaming casinos and the effect that that's had both on the Ojibwe population and the surrounding white population. I've written about Well, the battle we continue to have in my state over hunting and fishing treaty rights. I've written about the influx of the drug and the gang cultures on the reservation. Always at some level in my work, I deal with the whole question of racial prejudice. There are 14 novels currently in the Cork O'Connor series. I began in 1998 with a novel called Iron Lake. That was followed by Boundary Waters, Purgatory Ridge, Blood Hollow, Mercy Falls, Copper River, Thunder Bay, Red Knife, Heaven's Keep, Vermilion Drift, Northwest Angle, Trickster's Point, last year Tamarack County, and this year, number 14, Windigo Island. I had, in all of that publication, time to actually do two novels that are not a part of my series. A very early novel that is what in the business we call a standalone thriller, a book called The Devil's Bed. And last year, as Beth indicated, I came up with a novel called Ordinary Grace, which has won a number of awards up to this point in time, including the Edgar Award, which is, for those of you who don't know, is given by the Mystery Writers of America in recognition for the best novel published in the previous year. It's up for three more awards at the International Mystery Convention that's going to take place in Long Beach in November. But you know, something else, all of those things are really great for Ordinary Grace, but something else has begun to happen with Ordinary Grace that's really, for me, very interesting and really very satisfying. It's being chosen across the country by communities for their One Book, One Community Read program. Do you guys have a One Book, One Community Read here program in Denver? Then you know about it. So I just love the idea of a One Book, One Community Read, especially if it's my book they happen to choose for it. But, you know, in those communities that are having this program, I like to imagine that during the time that this is going on, you know, people in that community, instead of when they're, you know, standing in the checkout line at the grocery store, instead of focusing on the tabloids and, you know, whatever goofy shenanigans the Kardashians happen to be up to that week, instead maybe they're talking with each other about a book. Wouldn't that be amazing? And then I began thinking, so why stop there? Why just a One Book, One Community read? Why not a One Book, One State read, in which an entire state decides they're going to embrace a particularly fine novel and gather around it, rally around it? And then I thought, well, why stop there? Why not a One Book, One Nation read? Wouldn't that be great? Whereas an entire people, we gather and talk and embrace one particular work of a fine literary quality. And then I thought, why stop there? And you're going to have to let go of some things to go to this place with me on here. Okay. So, why not a Super Bowl of books? Why not have an event at the end of every year in which two really fine novels battled it out for a literary supremacy? And you know how in the NFL leading up to the Super Bowl, you've got week after week of the playoffs? What if in the Super Bowl of books, every week you had a book off? And so each week, one of the books that's in contention gets eliminated. And as your book, the book that you're championing, rises higher and higher and gets closer and closer to that ultimate event, everybody just got really excited about it. And what if, on the day of the Super Bowl of books, instead of the television being filled with commercials about Cheetos and cars and things we don't really give a damn about, what if every commercial was about a book? Wouldn't that be incredible? Wouldn't that say a lot about us as a people, right? Yeah, dream on, I know. But you know, unless you dream, things are never going to happen. All right. So I told you that the books I write very often involve an issue that arises out of the Ojibwe community. I am not at all afraid to take on issues in the work that I do. In fact, that's one of the things I like about being a mystery writer. What I've discovered is that I can use that platform to talk about issues, social issues that are important to me. And so long as I couch the issue within the context of a really compelling mystery, even people who don't necessarily agree with my point of view are still going to read me. You know, occasionally I do get emails from readers who complain that my admittedly liberal, bleeding heart sensibilities find their way into my stories, but I've never had anybody tell me they're not going to read me because of it. And honestly, how often is it that you get the chance to stand up on a soapbox and spout off without giving the other side an opportunity for rebuttal? Yeah, I really love that about what I do. So, Wendigo Island is the most issue-oriented book that I've written to date. And let me tell you how it came about. Several years ago, I began working significantly with a couple of Native organizations in the Twin Cities, an organization called the Enda Young Center in St. Paul and an organization called the Minnesota Indian Women's Resource Center in Minneapolis. The Enda Young Center in St. Paul is an organization that takes homeless Native youths off the street and gets them a home, feeds them, gives them the encouragement and the wherewithal to complete their education, helps them with job training, gives them the skills that are going to be necessary for them to go out on their own and create a life that they can be proud of. On the other side of the river in Minneapolis, the Minnesota Indian Women's Resource Center does very much the same thing with Native women. They take homeless Native women, many of whom have children, and they give them a place to live. They help them get food. Women who might be involved in some sort of substance abuse issue and who want to kick that particular habit, they help find the resources for them to do that so they can create the kind of life they really want for themselves. Many of the women who come to them are involved in the sex traffic and don't want to be. And the Minnesota Indian Women's Resource Center helps guide them to a different place in their lives. And in the course of my talks with these folks over the last couple of years, I became aware of a situation that just shocked, horrified me. I live in Minnesota. I live in the Twin Cities. I think of it as one of the most humane, generous places in this nation. That's one of the reasons I live there. And then I became aware that the Twin Cities and a large city north of us, Duluth, Minnesota, are among the largest urban areas in our country involved in the trafficking of vulnerable Native girls and women. It really cuts across all cultural lines, but in Minnesota, a very large part of the population involved in the sex traffic is Native. I didn't know that. Most white folks there don't know that. And the truth is, most Native people in Minnesota either don't know it or choose not to acknowledge it. And when I became aware of this and in the context of the discussions I was having with these folks, they asked me, Kent, could you write a story that might help broaden the awareness of this issue so that more people know about it, more people will join us in the battle to change this? And when they put that question to me, how could I say no? But there's a problem. I write a popular mystery series. I write stories that I want to entertain people with. And so here I am trying to figure out, how am I going to present what is the darkest story probably that I've ever written to readers who want, in addition to everything else, to be entertained? How am I going to pull somebody into a dark story and compel them to make that whole journey with me? Well, one of the things that I've learned across all of my years as a storyteller, particularly as a storyteller in mysteries, is that the most effective tool I have in my bag of tricks is one word: suspense. Suspense. And so I thought if I could tell a really good suspenseful story, maybe I could hook people in and they would follow me all the way to the end. Now, suspense is kind of a vague term. And when I teach mystery writing to my students, we spend a lot of time focusing on what is suspense. How do you create suspense? How do you heighten suspense? How long do you hold readers in suspense before you give them that payoff? So in order for you to understand really what I'm talking about when I say I wanted to write a suspenseful story, I'm going to take you through an exercise I take my students to introduce them to the whole idea of suspense. Okay, so if you want to know what suspense is all about, this is what I'd like you to do this evening. When you leave this event, I want you to go home. And if you have a particularly pesky neighbor, somebody you're not really very fond of, invite that neighbor over to your house. Set down two chairs in your kitchen facing each other. Sit down with your neighbor and begin a conversation for 5 minutes. And it doesn't matter what you talk about for those 5 minutes. You can talk about the prospects of the Broncos this year, how the Rockies are doing, whatever. For 5 minutes. And at the end of 5 minutes, I want you to do this. I want you to get up. I want you to go to the drawer where you keep your duct tape. Take out your roll of duct tape. And, yes, duct tape your neighbor to the chair. Then I want you to go over to the kitchen drawer where you keep your .38 caliber revolver. Pull that revolver out. Open the cylinder. Slip in one bullet. Slap the cylinder closed and give it a spin. Then I want you to sit down facing your neighbor and begin your conversation again for 5 more minutes, but with this difference. Put that revolver to your neighbor's forehead, and once every minute, pull the trigger. I guarantee you, it doesn't matter what you talk about. It's going to be the most riveting conversation either of you have ever been a part of. No, don't go home and do that. Don't go home and do that. Disclaimer. What I'm getting at is simply this. Suspense is not about what's happening in the present moment. Suspense is about what might happen in the next moment. It's creating a situation in which the outcome is important but uncertain. It's asking a question and delaying the answer to that question. It's raising a concern and delaying the answer to that the addressing of that concern. It's posing a threat and delaying the resolution of that threat. And it's in that delay, the time between the asking of the question and its answer, between raising the concern and addressing that concern, between posing the threat and resolving that threat, that suspense occurs. And typically speaking, the longer you can stretch that delay, that time out, the tauter the suspense. As a mystery writer, you use suspense in lots of different ways in your novel. But one of the most important things that you do with it is simply what we call the hook and pull. The hook and pull. Okay. So when I teach mystery writing, I teach the novel this way. Think of the novel as a river. And your reader is standing at the headwaters of that river without any real reason to join you on this journey down a river they don't really know anything about. So what you need to do as a writer, as a storyteller, is give them a reason to join you in that journey. So often what you're going to do is give them something very suspenseful up front that's going to hook them and pull them into this journey with you. So what I'm going to do right now is read to you the opening scene from Windigo Island to show you the way in which I decided I was going to bring readers into this particular story. With the hope that I might hook them. This is how I open Windigo Island. Fear is who we are. Cork's old friend Henry Malou had told him that. Though not quite in that way. And it was only part of what the ancient Ojibwe Mide had said. These were his exact words. In every human being, there are two wolves constantly fighting. One is fear, and the other is love. When Cork had asked which of the wolves won the battle, Malou's answer had been, "The one you feed. Always the one you feed." In his own life, Cork had known more than his share of fear. He carried scars from multiple gunshot wounds, and was scarred, too, in ways that never showed on skin. He'd lost his wife to violence, lost friends in the same manner. More than once, men whose hearts were black holes of hate had targeted his children, and he'd come close to losing them as well. In all this, fear had sometimes been the wolf he'd fed. But as Malou had wisely observed, love also shaped the human spirit, and it was this element of his being that Cork had consciously done his best to feed. In far more ways than fear, this wolf had shaped the man he was. There were different kinds of fear, Cork knew, and some had nothing to do with violence. They were sought out purposely, sought for the sake of excitement, an adrenaline rush. A roller coaster ride, for example, or a ghost story. When he finally began his investigation, Cork discovered that it was the desire for this kind of fear that had brought the three boys to the cursed place the Anishinaabeg called Windigo Island. When they set out that moonlit night, this was what the boys knew, what all the local kids knew. On Windigo Island, death came in the dark. It came in the form of an awful spirit, a cannibal beast with an insatiable craving for human flesh. Sometimes the beast swept in with a foul odor of carnage pouring off its huge body and a bone-chilling scream leaping from its maw. Sometimes it approached with stealth and wile, and in the moment before it ripped your heart from your chest, it cried your name in a high, keening voice. It could be unpredictable, but one thing was certain. To set foot on Windigo Island in the dead of night was to call forth the worst of what the darkness there held. They'd shoved off in their kayaks a few minutes before midnight from the marina on the shore of Lake Superior. It was late July, hot, and there was not a breath of wind. A gibbous moon had risen over the Apostle Islands. The water of Kichigami was black satin, smooth and shiny. Behind them, the lights of the reservation town of Bad Bluff curved along the shoreline of that greatest of the Great Lakes, and the three boys paused in their paddling and turned back to admire the sequined hills. Then wordless, because it was a night and an excursion that called for silence, they pushed on, following the path the moonlight burned in silver across the water. Ahead of them rose the island. It wasn't much to look at in daylight, a rough circle a couple of dozen yards in diameter, all of it broken stone, an island so tiny it appeared only on detailed nautical charts. From its center rose a tall, ragged pine, a tree that had somehow managed to put down roots in that humping of stone, and had held to it tenaciously through season after season of November gales. The Ojibwe believed the pine was a lightning rod of sorts, a beacon attracting the evil spirits of Kichigami to that cursed island. Not just the Windigo, but Michipeshu, too. A monster that lived in the depths, a creature with horns and the face of a panther and razor-sharp spikes down its back, and, some said, the body of a serpent. To the boys on that night, the tree looked like a black feather rising stiffly from the head of a skull almost completely submerged. They approached in silence, the only sound the dip of their double-bladed paddles and the burble of water as they stroked. They came at the island from the west and eased their kayaks up to the rocky shoreline. They disembarked one at a time, drew their crafts out of the water, and laid them carefully across the broken stone. The moonlight was intense, casting shadows of the ragged pine boughs across the boys like a black net. And they stood a moment, caught in the eerie mystique of the island. Then one of the boys farted. The long, low growl broke the spell, and they laughed, released from the grip of their own fear. "Dude," one of them said, "you let the Windigo know we're here." "Dude," the offending boy replied, "that was to keep him away." The third boy waved a hand in front of his face. "If that smell doesn't drive him off, nothing will." "Okay, what now?" the first asked. The third boy reached into the opening of his kayak and brought out a knapsack. From it, he pulled a can of white spray paint. "We find the biggest rock that faces town," which they did. It stood a good 4 feet high and had a nice flat vertical surface. In the daylight, it would have been dull gray. But in the shadow of the pine that night, it was as black as char. The third boy knelt in front of the rock as if praying, gave the can a good shake, then carefully sprayed his message. "Kyle B. plus Lori D." "How's she gonna see it?" the second boy asked. "Binoculars, dude, binoculars. I told her I was gonna come out here to do this thing, and the hell with the Windigo." The first boy stood back and admired the other's work. "Awesome. Totally." and that's when the wind hit. On a lake like Superior, weather can develop suddenly. That night the wind came out of nowhere, sweeping in from the vast open water. The limbs of the pine began flailing wildly, and waves rose up and crashed against Windigo Island and ate the rocks. No storm cloud obscured the stars or the unblinking eye of the moon, nothing to account for the phantom torrent of air that carried with it a frigid cold churned up from the depths. There was something in this wind that was terrible, something unnatural, and the boys could feel it. They stood frozen, feeding the wolf of fear suddenly prowling inside them. "Hey, you guys!" the first boy hollered over the cry of the wind. "Did you hear that?" "What?" the third boy shouted. "I heard it," the second boy called back. His voice was a high screech because, in his terror, his throat had closed nearly shut. He stared wide-eyed at the third boy. "Your name! It called your name!" The third boy turned from his companions, turned his face into that furious wind, and listened. He didn't hear what they'd heard, but he saw something that made his blood run cold. In the black roil of the lake, just beneath the surface, a figure, luminescent white under the glare of the moon, swam toward them. "Oh, God!" the first boy cried. "Michi Peshu!" He spun and fled, stumbling over the broken rocks toward his kayak. The second boy was close on his heels. The third boy turned, too, but caught his foot in a crevice between two stones, and his ankle gave in an agonizing twist. He went down with a cry of pain that was snatched away by the wind. His companions didn't hear. They were already on the water, already digging the blades of their paddles into the swells. The boy cried out for them, but they didn't look back. Then he heard it, what they'd heard. His name. His name called in a high, keening voice that was carried inside the howl of the wind. And he saw the white form sliding toward him in the black water, the monster Michi Peshu coming, and he watched it slither onto the rocks, and he knew a fear such as he'd never known before. The wolf inside him opened its hungry mouth and prepared to feed.
Thank you.
So I'm hoping I hooked you and pulled you in there with that one. Okay, so that's Windigo Island. Let me just give you, those of you who might be interested, an update on what's in the future for me, for Cork O'Connor, for other projects. Windigo Island is the first of a three-book contract I have with my publishing house. There is also another Cork O'Connor novel included in that contract. But between those two Cork O'Connor novels, I'm working on another project. For those of you who have read the novel Ordinary Grace, it is a companion novel to Ordinary Grace. It's called This Tender Land. This Tender Land. And I call it a companion novel as opposed to a sequel because it doesn't take place in the same town that Ordinary Grace took place, nor does it deal with the same characters. It's companion in that it also takes place in southern Minnesota, as did Ordinary Grace, rather than the northern Minnesota of the Cork O'Connor series. And it is set in an earlier time. Ordinary Grace was set in 1961. This Tender Land is set in 1958. I am approaching the end of the first draft of this particular novel, and I have to tell you, I am almost in love with it as much as I was with Ordinary Grace. I'm just having a wonderful time with this particular project, and I'm believing it's going to be, for those of you who enjoyed Ordinary Grace, I think it will be a worthy companion. That's the good news. The bad news is that for those of you who I hope eagerly await my books, it's going to be a year and a half before that novel comes out. It won't be out until the spring of 2016. And I asked for that additional time from my publisher. Typically, when you write a series with a large New York publishing house, you're pretty much contractually required to deliver at least a book a year. But for those of you who know my work, you know I had two books out last year. Ordinary Grace and number 13 in the Cork O'Connor series, Tamarack County. So I spent most of last year on the road doing events like this. And it did two things. It wore me out. And it also didn't give me the time that I really wanted to make sure that I was going to do a great, what I hope is a great job on this tender land. So they were very understanding. So it'll be a year and a half before this tender land comes out, spring of 2016. As for the next Cork O'Connor, which would be number 15 in the series, I have not a single idea for that book at the moment. So listen, if you've got anything you'd like to shoot my way, you just go right ahead and do that. And if I decide to use it, I might even acknowledge you for that. You know, that's pretty much what I have to say to you this evening in terms of prepared remarks. But if you have anything that you'd like to ask me right now, this is your opportunity, because as Beth was telling me, I'm apparently never going to be invited back to the Tattered Cover again. No, I'm just kidding you. I'm just kidding you. Do you have any questions out there? Question is, where am I teaching? Where am I teaching? I teach at a variety of venues. I used to teach a lot more than I do now. Any teachers here? Okay. To be a good teacher, and you know this, requires an enormous amount of preparation. It takes a lot of energy. The payback is stupendous for it, unless you're working in the public school system. I don't think you guys ever get paid enough. But it requires an enormous amount of time and energy, and I would rather give that time and energy selfishly to my own writing right now. But I still do teach on occasion. I just finished teaching at a workshop in Ball State University in Indiana. I did workshop work. Where was that? That was in Nashville. I gave some workshops in Nashville. And so I do conference work when I'm asked to participate in a very limited university program. I'll do that. But I don't teach as much as I used to. Yeah. There was a question here.
What drew you to the Iron Range?
What drew me to the Iron Range? Are you a ranger? Where from?
Hoyt Lakes.
Hoyt Lakes. Okay. I just want you to know I don't write about that aurora. You understand that, right? Okay. For those of you who don't understand what we're talking about here, up in Cork O'Connor lives in Aurora, Minnesota. There is a real Aurora, Minnesota, about 40 miles from where I have set my aurora. And the way aurora came about was this. In my first book, Iron Lake, there is a myth that runs through that, the myth of the Wendigo. That's where I introduced the Wendigo to readers. And in that first draft of that book, the town where Cork lived was called Wendigo. If you're Ojibwe, it's Wendigo. But it began to be kind of confusing whether I was talking about the mythical creature or the town itself. So my editor said, I think you should have a new name. So I thought a lot about what name did I want to give to this town that was in the North Country. And the name that was most evocative of the North Country to me was Aurora. That just so cried the North. So I talked to my editor and I said, I want to call my town Aurora, but there's already a real Aurora up there. Can I do that? And his response was, well, okay, so long as you don't do anything that's going to get us sued, you just go right ahead. So I created Aurora, which is only confusing for people who know the Arrowhead of Minnesota. What drew me to that area was simply this. I'm not native to Minnesota. I didn't move there. My wife and I moved there from Denver so that she could go to the U of M Law School. And right away, well, pretty much right away, we began doing what a lot of people in Minnesota do. We began vacationing up north, in the North Country. We started spending a portion of some of our summers at a YMCA camp way up north. A place called Camp Du Nord, and it's literally across the road from the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness. For those of you who don't know what the Boundary Waters is, it's 2 million acres of pristine forest, lakes, fast-running streams and rivers that straddles the Canadian border. It is the most heavily used wilderness area in the United States. The reason? It is the most remarkably beautiful wilderness area, I think, in the whole United States. And when I discovered that country, that remarkable territory, I thought somebody should be writing stories about this place. So I always knew that when I got serious, what I would write about would be the Great North Woods of Minnesota. So that's what drew me to the Iron Range. For those of you who don't know anything about the Iron Range is a remarkable geologic formation that runs through much of northern Minnesota. There are actually three ranges involved, the Cuyuna Range, the Vermilion Range, the Mesabi Range. And the Iron Range was incredibly important to the history of this nation. It was the Iron Range iron that made the steel that helped us fight and win both World War I and World War II, a tremendously important resource for us. The iron mines are closing these days. The demand for iron is down. Steel, you can get steel in cheaper ways. So it's a very changing landscape now, economically, culturally, socially, all of those ways. But it's still an incredible place, just an incredible place. So if you ever come to Minnesota, you ought to schedule a little time to go up and see the Iron Range. We have one of the largest open pit mines in the world there, the Rust Hole Mine. And I began one of my novels with an image of the Rust Hole Mine. Cork's morning began that day with the worst wound he'd ever seen. It was a mile wide, 2 miles long, 500 feet deep. It bled iron, which is the Rust Hole Mine. Yeah. What else? Any other questions here? None.
I'm curious, did you know when
you started with Cork, many novels, what we're going to follow? Yeah. Like, was it just like, hey, I'm going to write with this character? Do you have a feel when you started with that? What, tell us the history of the Cork. Thank you, Beth. The question was, did I know when I began that first novel that I was going to be at, have, you know, 14, 15, whatever more in me? Absolutely not. And I've never talked to an author in my business who has. We always begin writing that first manuscript simply with the hope that we're going to write something that is good enough, somebody's actually going to want to buy it, and readers will actually want to read it. In Cork O'Connor's case, when I was probably two-thirds of the way through the writing of that manuscript, I realized I was creating relationships that were so complex I would never be able to wrap them all up at the end of one novel. And I thought, okay, so how long is it going to take me to bring all of these people to the place I want them to be? And I thought, probably three books. And that's exactly it. So across the course of the first three novels in this series, Iron Lake, Boundary Waters, and Purgatory Ridge, the O'Connor clan is doing a dance of reconciliation that brings them all together so that they become the O'Connors that really fill so many of the emotional needs of the stories going forward. Here's kind of the story of the publication of Iron Lake. Okay, here's a confession coming from a mystery writer. Before I began to write mysteries, I didn't read them. My father was a high school English teacher, you know, and he did his best to raise his children on literature with a capital L. I didn't even read the Hardy Boys or Nancy Drew when I was growing up. So when I decided at 40 years of age, I was tired of trying to write the great American novel and not doing a very good job of it. I decided I want to write something that somebody will want to read. So I looked around me to see what people are reading. And what do people read? Yeah, they read mysteries. It cuts across all socioeconomic levels. So I thought, okay, I'm going to write a mystery. Didn't know anything about mysteries. So I had a lot of catching up to do. But one of the first things I did was to take a class at a place called the Loft Literary Center in Minneapolis. It's the largest independent center devoted to the written word in the United States. Do you know the Loft? You're nodding. Okay. Loft is a great place. So I took basically Mystery Writing 101. It worked. I wrote the first chapter for Iron Lake in that class. And when those of us who had participated in that class were finished with it, and we wanted to continue that critiquing, that sharing experience, so we formed a mystery writers support group that still exists today. I had to leave it last year, but across 20 years, every Wednesday night we met to read and critique each other's work. We call ourselves, get this, creme de la crime. Yeah, it's cute, but it works. So across the 4 years I was writing Iron Lake, I was reading that manuscript to the folks in my group, and they were critiquing it. And at the end of those 4 years, when we all thought, okay, it's time to see if this baby has legs and can stand, I did what you were supposed to do back then. This was in the mid-1990s. I sent it to 36 New York agents. Why New York? part of the publishing business. I sent query letters to 36 of them. I got 6 responses. All of them said, no, thank you very much. They were all just form letters. In fact, there were sometimes pretty bad form letters. A couple of them came to me Xeroxed, and they were like crooked on the page, you know? About that same point in time, some of the folks in my mystery writers group went to a conference in Chicago, and they came back and they said, it was a mystery conference, and they said, we have your agent. The keynote speaker that year was a woman named Jane Jordan Brown, who had a literary agency in Chicago, and her keynote speech was, how do you get an agent? My friends brought me back a tape of her talk, and I listened to it, and it seemed to me she wasn't saying, this is how you get any old agent. She was saying, this is how you get me, Jane Jordan Brown, as your agent. And when I listened really carefully, it seemed to me all Jane was saying to the gathered wannabe authors there was, say something very nice about me in your query letter. So that's what I did. I came up with a great compliment to lead off my query letter to Jane. I sent it to her, and 2 weeks later, I got a call from her. She said, I want to see your manuscript. I sent it. 6 weeks later, she got back to me, and that's a sign of a good agent. It's a very quick turnaround time. And she said, I'm not going to represent you. Your novel's too long. It was 500 manuscript pages. She said, I can't publish a novel this long by a first author. But if you're willing to cut it by 100 pages, I'll take a look at it. You know, that was like asking me to cut off my right arm. Yeah, exactly. But if that's what it was going to take, that's what I was going to do. So I reeled it in, and over the course of the next year, I actually cut it by 120 pages. It was the best thing I could have done. I sent it back to Jane. She said, this is great. I'm going to represent you. Let's go. She sent it in November of that particular year to 6 of the large New York publishing houses with this very bold demand. Do you want to publish Kent's book? Give us an answer by Christmas. Well, yeah, what I didn't know about the publishing business is that nothing happens at Christmas. For 2 weeks before Christmas and 2 weeks after Christmas, they're pretty much gone to the Poconos or the Berkshires or Florida, wherever they go for their vacations. And kind of the publishing business in New York grinds to a halt. So, Chris, what was that? Yeah, kind of like Congress. fortunately, the publishing houses aren't quite as dangerous as Congress can be. So Christmas rolls around and we haven't heard anything. The New Year's rolls around, we still haven't heard anything. I remember a bleak night in the middle of January. I'm sitting at the kitchen table. My wife, Diane, is beside me. I've got my head in my hands, and I'm whining something like, nobody wants my book. Nobody wants my book. Well, I get a call from Jane the next day. She says, somebody wants your book. It was an offer from St. Martin's Press, one of the best mystery imprints in the business. She said, it's a first author contract, not a lot of money, but somebody wants your book. I said, wonderful, Jane. Where do I sign? She said, you're not going to sign because I think you're going to get another offer. The next day, we got another offer. This one came from Simon & Schuster, and it was a better offer. I said, wonderful, Jane. Where do I sign? And she said, you're not going to sign because I've called St. Martin's and told them about Simon & Schuster's offer. I think they'll make a counteroffer. The next day, we get a counteroffer. St. Martin says, not only will we give him more for Iron Lake, we know he's at work on a second novel, we'll buy that one too. I said, oh, wonderful, Jane, wonderful. Where do I sign? And she said, you're not going to sign. Because I've called Simon & Schuster and told them about St. Martin's offer. I think they'll make a counteroffer. And the next day we got a two-book offer from Simon & Schuster that was so good we couldn't turn it down. So that's kind of how that whole experience occurred. Thank you for asking, Beth. Yeah. Yes.
Why Ordinary Grace in the middle of all the
Corporal? How many here have read Ordinary? The question is, why Ordinary Grace in the middle of all of this? For those of you who didn't raise your hands, here's the down and dirty on Ordinary Grace. Ordinary Grace is set in the summer of 1961 in a small town deep in the very beautiful Minnesota River Valley. It's the story of a Methodist minister whose beloved child is murdered. That's the compelling mystery component. But at heart, it's really the story of what that terrible tragedy does to this man's faith, his family, and ultimately the entire fabric of the small town in which he lives. I wrote Ordinary Grace because I could not write it. About 6 years ago, a story idea came to me, and it was so compelling that I didn't want to turn my back on it. I knew it was going to be a risky proposition if I wrote this novel, and for this reason. The The only two books that I've written that are not a part of my series, I told you, were The Devil's Bed and Ordinary Grace. The Devil's Bed came out, it was my fourth published novel. And anybody here read The Devil's Bed? Yeah, three of you, I think. Yeah, you were the only three people in the entire universe who did read The Devil's Bed. And people stayed away from it, not because it wasn't a good novel, it got great reviews. People stayed away because Cork O'Connor wasn't in it, and readers were unwilling to follow me to a place that didn't have Cork. And my publisher called me out to New York City after that sales debacle and sat me down and said, Kent, we only want Cork O'Connor novels from you. But 6 years ago, a story idea came to me that was so compelling and was not a Cork O'Connor novel. And I knew that if I wrote it, if I spent the time writing it, it was going to be great risk because I had no guarantee anybody would want it. But I had to write it. And so I cleared the decks, and over the course of the next 3 years, every moment that wasn't devoted to a contractual obligation in my Cork O'Connor series, I spent writing the manuscript for Ordinary Grace. For me, Ordinary Grace is that place where two important journeys in my life come together, my journey as a writer and my spiritual journey. And it has been so satisfying to me on so many levels that I couldn't be happier that I went ahead and took that risk. And this is one of the things that I tell my students when I teach is, I think you have to take risks in this business. If you only stay with what's safe, you're never going to grow. From great risk comes very often great reward. Great reward personally, and it can have great reward in terms of the business that we do too. Ordinary Grace is on track to way outsell any of my individual Cork O'Connor novels. Yeah. Yeah. The comment here. The comment here is for this absolutely lovely perceptive reader. One of the most compelling things about the story is the relationship of two of the boys. The story is narrated by Frank Drum in his 13th year. He's really telling this story from 40 years later, but it's about the time he was 13 years old, and so you often hear his 13-year-old voice giving you this story. Frank Drum has a younger brother, Jake, and if you asked me what really the foundation for the whole story is, it's the relationship between Frank and Jake and what they discover together about the world, about each other, about their family through the course of that novel. Yeah, thank you, thank you. Any other? Yeah, Steve.
throughout your series with Cork series, how do your characters progress as far as age? Is it 1 year, one book, or can they vary?
Yeah, Steve's question was: across the course of the novel, there are now 14 of them. How have the characters aged? Has it been 1 year per book, or exactly how has that worked? And, you know, it sort of fits and starts. Sometimes a year has passed, sometimes less than a year has passed. Between two of the novels, in fact, between several of the novels, occasionally, only a few months will have passed. Between Mercy Falls and Copper River, those two books come together and just a few days separate those two books. Between Boundary Waters and Purgatory Ridge is just a few months. But very often, as the series moved on, the time frame would be a year. So across the course of this series, the Cork O'Connor clan have all aged approximately 12 years. And this is one of the things that I like about that. Thank you for this introducing me. Thanks for the segue into what I'm going to say next, Steve. I write what I like to think of as a dynamic protagonist. When you make a decision to have a series that's based on a single protagonist or has a single protagonist at its heart, you have really only two choices, it seems to me, in terms of the kind of protagonist that you can create. You can create a static protagonist or you can create a dynamic protagonist. What's a static protagonist? Someone who never changes, someone who's the same book to book to book, story to story to story. Think Sherlock Holmes. You read one Sherlock Holmes story, he's going to be the same in all the other stories you read. A modern version of that might be, if you know Sue Grafton's work, the Kinsey Millhone series, her A is for Alibi, B is for Burglary, C is for whatever, C is for Corpse. Sue's been writing that series now 30 years. I think she has 20, maybe 22, 23 novels in it. And across the whole course of that series, those 20-some-odd books, those 30 years, Kinsey Millhone has aged 6 months. Yeah, it's always like 1980-something in a Kenzie Milhone novel. So that's a static protagonist. What's a dynamic protagonist? That's somebody who changes, somebody who ages across the course of the series, someone for whom what happens in one story is reflected in the subsequent novels in how that character responds to the world. So Cork and his family, across the course of my series, they've all aged about 12 years. When I began writing Iron Lake, I saw Cork as a man in his early 40s. In Tamarack County, last year's book, I nailed him at 54, 12 years. And that, do you know, that does something for me that's satisfying personally, but I also hope it does something for the readers. And I hope this is what it does. For me, it means that every time I sit down to write about Cork O'Connor and his family, I'm writing about different people. They're not the same people they were in the last book. They've aged. Things have happened to them that have changed how they relate to the world and to one another. It's a journey, and that's what I hope readers recognize who come to this series. I hope that's part of what brings you back and keeps you interested. You come back wondering, what's up with the Cork O'Connor clan now? Where are these people in their lives? How are they doing? I just love, that's what keeps it exciting for me, being a part of that dynamic journey. Thanks for the segue. I appreciate it. Yeah, right here.
How much time do you have to read other things?
The question is, how much time do I have to read other things? Do you know, if I had to say there is one downside to becoming a multi-published author of a popular series, is the time that you have to read is reduced to not much. Most of the reading I do these days is reading I do for the business. They are bound galleys, or what we call advanced reader's copies, ARCs, that have been sent to me with the hope that I might offer a dust jacket quote. And I do that. I try not to turn down too many of them, because it's a generous community that I'm a part of, and I was helped in my coming of age in this business, and I want to help others as they try to establish themselves. So that's most of the reading that I do these days. I'm on tour now, so I have turned down a couple of folks, and I'm hoping that I don't get hit up again until maybe the tour is finished, because I'm thinking I might actually pick up a book and read it on the airplanes and in the airports, something I really want to read. Now, that said, one of the things I love best about that is I'm the first to discover great new writers. Doesn't happen always. In fact, doesn't happen a lot. Usually people are very good at what they do, but every once in a while, I'll read a story that just knocks my socks off, and I'm thinking, this person's editor and me are the first people who've read this story, and readers are going to soon know this name. So that's the upside of that. Yeah, thanks for asking. Yeah, you had a hand. Yeah, the question is, how do I know the Ojibwe culture? How do I know the Anishinaabe? When I told you that when I was answering the question about the Iron Range, that I became aware of northern Minnesota and its beauty, and after I moved there, and when I decided that I was going to set my work, whatever I did, up in northern Minnesota. And I took a really good look at northern Minnesota, the history of it, and all the cultural diversity up there. I became aware that you can't really tell a real story of northern Minnesota without including somehow the Ojibwe as an element of those stories, because their influence is ubiquitous. Didn't know anything about them. But I was a cultural anthropology major in college, and so the idea of learning about the culture of the Anishinaabe was exciting to me. So I began by doing what every good academic does. I began by reading. I read everything I could get my hands on. And in the course of that, I began to meet members of the Ojibwe community, some of them through my wife, actually. And when I thought I had a really good grasp of the Ojibwe, I sat down and I wrote Iron Lake, and then I gave it to a couple of Ojibwe readers and asked for their input, which I still try to do whenever I've got enough time between finishing the manuscript and the deadline to allow that to happen. But for every book, I do a great deal of research, because every story I try to approach the culture from a different angle to offer the readers a different perspective, something they might not have seen before. For Windigo Island, I did an enormous amount of research. I talked to lots of folks in the Ojibwe community who are involved in this particular issue. I think it's one of the best choices I made to offer the reader a perspective on a culture they're most people, even in Minnesota, aren't familiar with. It's been, my exploration has been rich. I've discovered them to be complex, incredibly funny. I did an event with a guy named Jim Northrup last night. He's one of the best Chenab storytellers I've ever heard. And he just had us in stitches last night. His humor was just so amazing. So that's kind of where all of that knowledge comes from. And I'm just so grateful that they've been so generous in sharing with me a lot of what they've shared. Let's end on that note. I want to say two things before I start signing. First of all, I hope you're here because you like my work. But I also hope you're here in some part to support the tattered cover, to support your local independent bookstore. Because if you don't support your local independent bookstores, they're not going to be around. And if the locals are gone, and we know that Barnes & Noble are struggling, and they go, who's left? You know who's left. And who do you want making the choices about the reading that's available to you? Thank you for buying here at your local independent bookstore, folks. Thanks for coming this evening.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.